Good evening, listeners and students of Hitler's Table Talk. It is New Year's Day here in Texas, USA, on January 1st, 2015. I'm Carolyn Yeager.
And I'm Ray Goodwin.
And Happy New Year to you, Ray.
And Happy New Year back at you, Carolyn, and to all our listeners. We're glad to have them with us on New Year's Day.
Well, sure, if we have them. We don't know, but yeah, there might be some of them here. Boy, it's been a long time, hasn't it?
Yes, it has been, like 3 weeks since we've had a show.
And I haven't used my microphone in all that since the last show I did. So it's quite amazing. It feels like I was hoping it would still work. I guess it does. So it's been a long time, and I'm feeling good about being on again, and I am feeling good about the new year for some reason. Not that I have any real reason to, but it just seems like 2015 sounds like a good year.
Sure.
And yesterday seemed like New Year's to me, but today has seemed like, I don't know, I've been a little lethargic. And it hasn't really gotten into my consciousness that it's a special day, New Year's Day. It just seems like any day. Yesterday seemed special, though. So I guess we're getting to be where we kind of get ahead of things and do our celebrating on the day before for the most part.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, Ray. We've got a great program tonight, episode 40, which I got really happy when I was reading it, particularly about the part where Hitler is talking about how to deal with treason and how he sees treason. I thought that's really excellent. And
sure,
we'll get to that. But to start out, we're starting on June 5th, 1942. Let's remember where we're at. And I've got a timeline here before we get started, saying that at Gazala, this is pretty interesting because it's about Rommel. At Gazala, British forces of the 8th Army, commanded by General Ritchie, launch a major counterattack against Rommel's forces in the Cauldron. The attack fails, partly because Rommel has already recovered his critical logistics situation and has established an excellent defensive position, but also in large part due to the German anti-tank tactics. The 32nd Army Tank Brigade, for example, that's the British, loses 50 of 70 tanks. By early afternoon, Rommel is clearly in control of the situation and attacks the British position known as Knightsbridge, and with something Ariete and the 21st Panzer Divisions. This several British tactical headquarters positions are overrun, and command and control of the British forces becomes problematic. As a result, several brigades are stranded in the Cauldron when the British retirement begins. In addition, the British suffer further heavy tank losses. Sounds terrible for the British, doesn't it?
Oh,
and
yeah.
Also on June 5th, 1942, the United States declares war on Bulgaria, Hungary, and Romania. And we will, not Hungary, Hungary, and we will be hearing more about Hungary in this, in tonight's program.
Yes.
Okay, so if you don't have anything you want to say about what's going on with Rommel there, we can get started.
All righty. You know, the 5th of June, 1942, at that point in the war, things were still positive for Germany.
Mm-hmm.
And the successes of Rommel kind of reflect that. So I'm glad you mentioned that. 5th of June, 1942, midday. Predisposition of the Finns to mental diseases. Effects of study of the Bible thereon. Religious mania. Germans must avoid spiritual sickness. The topic of conversation was the exceptionally large number of cases of mental disease in Finland. Among the causes put forward as possible explanations of the vulnerability of the Finns to these types of diseases were the aurora borealis and the strong inclination prevalent among Finns to worry unduly over religious problems. In Finland, the farms are often as much as 30 to 50 miles apart, and the inhabitants, condemned particularly in winter to a comparatively isolated existence, feel the need of mental exercise. An exceptionally strong tendency to religious surmise is therefore understandable. The Fuhrer expressed himself as follows.
Well, before you say what the Fuhrer, before you read what the Fuhrer says, I just want to point out in defense of the Finns here, if maybe they just, that was an idea that was going around then, but I looked for research. I looked on the internet for anything to do with Finns and mental illness or mental disease, and I didn't find a thing. I mean, nothing. So except
right.
this one little thing in schizophrenia.com that only talked about a study on schizophrenia that was well designed. It went for 40 years, and it focused on identifying the degree to which family environmental factors might play a protective role in those who are genetically susceptible to schizophrenia. Well, that might indicate that there was enough schizophrenics in Finland to do a study like this, but otherwise I didn't find anything that indicated that that's connected Finns with that mental disease. But
right.
So.
The Fuhrer expressed himself as follows. It is a great pity that this tendency towards religious thought can find no better outlet than the Jewish pettifoggery of the Old Testament. For religious people who, in the solitude of winter, continually seek ultimate light on their religious problems with the assistance of the Bible, must eventually become spiritually deformed. The wretched people strive to extract truths from these Jewish chicaneries, where in fact no truths exist. As a result, they become embedded in some rut of thought or other, and unless they possess an exceptionally common sense mind, degenerate into religious maniacs. It is deplorable that the Bible should have been translated into German, and that the whole of the German people should have thus become exposed to the whole of this Jewish mumbo-jumbo. So long as the wisdom, particularly of the Old Testament, remained exclusively in the Latin of the church, there was little danger that sensible people would become the victims of illusions as the result of studying the Bible. But since the Bible became common property, a whole heap of people have found open to them lines of religious thought which, particularly in conjunction with the German characteristic of persistent and somewhat melancholy meditation, as often as not, turned them into religious maniacs. When one recollects further that the Catholic Church has elevated to the status of saints a whole number of madmen, one realizes why movements such as that of the flagellants came inevitably into existence in the Middle Ages in Germany. As a sane German, one is flabbergasted to think that German human beings could have let themselves be brought to such a pass by Jewish filth and priestly twaddle that they were little different from the howling dervish of the Turks and the Negroes, at whom we laugh so scornfully. It angers one to think that while in other parts of the globe religious teaching like that of Confucius, Buddha, and Mohammed offers an undeniably broad basis for the religious-minded, Germans should have been duped by a theological exposition devoid of all honest depth. When one seeks reasons for these phenomena, one is immediately struck by the extent to which the human brain reacts to external influence. A child, for example, who in its very early years has been frightened with the threat of the bogeyman in the dark, will frequently retain throughout all the years of its development a fear of entering a dark room, a cellar, or the like. Among women, a fear of this nature inculcated in early youth often persists for a lifetime. On the other hand, there are dangers which, not ever having come to his notice, a man completely ignores. A child living in an area exposed to bombing and to whom the dangers of a bombardment have not been explained will regard an enemy air attack as a noisy firework display and will not, as a rule, show the slightest sign of fear. The essential conclusion to which these considerations leads me is that we must do everything humanly possible to protect for all time any further sections of the German people from the danger of mental deformity, regardless of whether it be religious mania or any other type of cerebral derangement. For this reason, I have directed that every town of any importance shall have an observatory, for astronomy has been shown by experience to be one of the best means at man's disposal for increasing his knowledge of the universe and thus saving him from any tendency toward mental aberration.
Yeah, you know, I just like that so much. And apart from all the wisdom that he gives in there, it's just his manner of speaking and his choice of words I find just delightful and
oh,
very
yeah.
Amusing and enjoyable. You know, and on he goes. The words he picks out are just describe things so well. And I also notice how he uses the word like sensible and a common sense mind, showing that he just doesn't go for anything that's too fanciful or far out, which would include all that occult stuff that people want to, put on him, which he didn't go along with. Well, what's your feeling about this section?
Well, yeah, pretty close to that. What affected me, kind of drew my attention to exactly what he was getting at here was when he says, when one recollects further that the Catholic Church has elevated to the status of saints a whole number of madmen, one realizes why movements such as that of the flagellants came inevitably into existence in the Middle Ages in Germany. And that these are just religious nuts that he's talking about that take it to the extreme. Probably any listeners would know what the flagellants are, who they were, why they were called that, and that was those people who were so devoutly religious, convicted, thought that their life had to be a life of suffering, and they would inflict pain upon themselves with something like a cat of nine tails that swing back over their, from the front, swing it back to the back, and whip themselves and bleed from the back and things like this to prove their religious dedication. And that's the kind of fanaticism that he's talking about. And so, hey, you know, that's why he says unless someone has a pretty good hold on common sense, they could become victims to this sort of thing. So you're right. It's a fascinating passage.
Yeah, I like that. When he said that this Catholic Church has elevated to the status of saints a whole number of madmen. You know, I mean, he just comes right out with it. You know, he doesn't mince words around. And that is those flagellants. You know, they thought that they were imitating Jesus because you know, there's a lot of ways you could imitate Jesus, but they picked out that one. You know, that he was beaten with before, and he was all bloody and stuff. So they had to do that to themselves to be worthy somehow of entering.
Right.
His presence, and I guess they really wanted to be the top level in his presence, so they were willing to do that kind of thing. It is nuttiness, and you wonder how somebody can go that far without coming to their senses. And he does, that's why I say, he mentions things like being sensible often and compares it to people who he says have just gone too far and lost their sense. I just loved all of this. I enjoyed reading it. I giggle and everything over it because he's just so he speaks about it in a way that just hits home. You know, it really hits home.
Sure, like someone very very much trained in psychology and psychiatry. You know, he just his knowledge of. Human behavior and all things about that religious stuff is just amazing. Every time I read something about it, I think that the man could really, he was a very in-depth thinker.
Well, and also I think what strikes me is how he just cuts through the bull, you know. He just cuts through the baloney. He just cuts right to the fact and he calls it what it is. He doesn't have any fear of being of somebody saying, "Oh, you don't understand this. You know, you have to understand what causes this and so on." He doesn't worry. He doesn't have any fear of that because he knows that he's right. Okay, so there's more good stuff to come. So let's keep going. So now we've got the next section. I don't have any timeline for this.
Right. 5th of June, June the 5th, 1942, at dinner. A saint is promoted to the rank of general. Now, that sentence right there has an exclamation point after it, and you'll see why. A report was submitted to the Fuhrer, according to which the Caudillo had decided in a decree dated 22nd September 1941 to award the full honors of a field marshal to Saint Funicula, the patron saint of Segovia, in recognition of the miracle she performed 5 years ago, whereby 3,000 nationalist soldiers under the command of De Valera, the minister of war at that time, were enabled successfully to defend that city against an assault by 15,000 Reds. He was told also of another case in which a saint was appointed general because when a bomb penetrated the church of which she was the patron saint, she prevented it from exploding. The Fuhrer intervened as follows.
Yeah, well, let's just say here that in case people don't know what a Caudillo is, it's a Spanish or Latin American military strongman. So the Caudillo, I think, is Franco, huh, that they're talking about.
Yes.
And he's going along with this these things where they give military ranks of the high level to saints because they think they perform miracles helping them to have military success. Yeah,
right.
Interesting. So.
Okay, the Fuhrer intervened as follows. I have the gravest possible doubts that any good can come of nonsense of this kind. I am following the development of Spain with the greatest skepticism, and I've already made up my mind that although eventually I may visit every other European country, I shall never go to Spain. And, you know, to me right there, he's saying there's just too doggone much, they're too deep in religious mania in that country. So,
yeah, this is 1942. I'm kind of surprised that he said that. Maybe he was just talking, because I think he did go to Spain after that. But it may have been in 42 that he went to Spain. That was the last time. Anyway, he did go there then, around that time, and met with Franco.
Franco.
But I just like the way he says he doubts that any good can come of nonsense of this kind. This is a bad precedent to do this.
Cutting to the chase.
Yeah.
Okay, we'll just move right on to the 7th of June, 1942, midday. Monarchical tendencies in Spain supported by the church. Same old tactics for the seizing of power. A new revolution in Spain would spell ruin. Two little requests from Admiral Horthy. The river Tisza is the Hungarian Rhine, Horthy's son. Enter Allied military commissions in 1925. Treason among Germans. The emigres of 1933. Views on the crime of treason. All traitors should be shot. Conscientious objectors. Settling with Bible students. During discussion about the Blue Division, the Spanish division serving on the Eastern Front, the conversation turned once more to the internal situation in Spain. Reichsleiter Bormann remarked that the increasing swing in favor of a monarchy received more than a little encouragement from the clergy. The Fuhrer agreed and continued. The activities of the church in Spain are no different from those of the Catholic Church in our own country, or indeed from those of most churches in any other country. Any church, provided it is in a position to exert influence on the civil regime, will, as a matter of principle, support or tolerate only such a regime as knows and recognizes no form of popular organization other than one under the aegis of the church, and is therefore dependent for purposes of general administration, solely on the church as the only organized leadership of the people, unless it is prepared to renounce that striving for power which is inherent in every church participating in politics, the church in Spain cannot recognize the present regime which has created in the Falange an organization of its own for the direction of the Spanish people. There is, therefore, only one thing the Falange can do to establish definite relations with the Church, and that is to limit the intervention of the latter to religious, that is, supernatural, affairs. If one once allows the Church to exercise the slightest influence on the governing of the people and the upbringing of the younger generation, it will strive to become omnipotent, and one makes a great mistake if one thinks that one can make a collaborator of the Church by accepting a compromise. The whole international outlook and political interest of the Catholic Church in Spain render inevitable conflict between the Church and the Franco regime, and a new revolution thus comes within the bounds of possibility. Spain may well have to pay with her blood in the not-too-distant future for her failure to carry through a truly national revolution as was done in Germany and Italy.
You want to comment on this part before we go on to the part about Hungary?
I didn't have anything here in particular.
Well,
the Blue Division and the Falange, you know, the Blue Division, what I read years ago, distinguished itself on the Eastern Front, the Spanish fighting for the German forces, and this Falange, an organization for the direction of the Spanish people, formed by Franco and his people. So, anyway.
Yeah, and Hitler was thought well of the Falange, and
yes,
and the nationalists in Spain are actually like what the communists were. The left wing is the nationalists.
Yeah.
Which is a little different, you see, and the and Franco is the I don't know what his, but the Falange, and they were the, but they tended toward the monarchy, and they tended toward Franco was very much aligned and under, in many ways under the control of the Catholic Church, because
yes,
he did not get power over and above the Church. He went along with the Church, and that's how they supported him. So he had to go along with a lot of things they said, which Hitler's talked about before, and he thinks that's a mistake. So he doesn't have a whole lot of regard for Franco, but he does see him as at least something of an ally.
Yes, yes, mm-hmm. and you know, and he knows it's because of the hold that the Church and the beliefs and all have on Franco.
Yeah. Now this part about Hungary I found really interesting in Calais and Horthy.
Mm-hmm.
So I've got a few notes about it to read afterwards.
Okay. Calais, the new Prime Minister of Hungary, came to me with two little requests from Regent Horthy, namely, that firstly the Lord God and secondly I myself should turn a benevolent blind eye if the Hungarians started a fight with the Romanians. From the Hungarian point of view, said Calais, such a fight would be a struggle against Asia, for the frontier between Europe and Asia was, in Hungarian eyes, the line where the Orthodox Church ceased to hold sway. It was, after all, he said, only the countries on this side of that frontier which had played their part in European cultural development and all its great accomplishments, such as the Reformation, the Renaissance, and the like. It was for this reason that Hungary had always been hostile to Russia and had at the time been at a loss to understand the policy of the Third Reich when it made its pact with Russia. Calais went on to point out that the River Theiss held the same significance for the Hungarians as did the Rhine for Germans. The Rhine, in German eyes, was a German river, and in the same way, the Tisza to Hungarians was not an international frontier but a national waterway.
Okay, you know, the Theiss is the German pronunciation and spelling of the Hungarian river Tisza.
Yeah.
I guess that's how they say it, Tisza. I don't know, but and the Germans are so used to using their own language names for so many of these things. So that's why I guess Hitler's saying that right there.
Yeah, I appreciate you pointing that out. In the field of domestic politics, Calais mentioned the necessity for a land reform act in Hungary. Such a reform, he thought, should, however, confine itself simply to increasing the size of the very smallest holdings. Calais then spoke of Horthy's son, whom he described as a great thruster, and whom he asserted the Hungarian troops fighting on our eastern front regarded as a great hero. This I can well believe, for I know that his father, the regent, is a man of exceptional courage. I must say, I think Horthy has worked out a very neat plan, for if his son wins his spurs fighting for the Germans, then the latter can hardly raise any objections if the Hungarians appoint him deputy to his father and eventually grace him with the glory of the crown of St. Stephen. Equally, Horthy's Hungarian political opponents can take no possible exception to the activities of Horthy Jr., since he has proved himself in the struggle against Bolshevism. Under the Weimar Republic, treason
okay.
assumed...
Okay, I'm going to... I want to talk about Horthy here a little bit.
Okay.
You know, this is sad, because I found out that... See, now this is early June 1942. In September 1942, this 37-year-old son of Horthy that Hitler was bragging about, who was supposed to have been a very brave soldier... his eldest son was killed. He was a flight lieutenant. He was deputy regent and a flight lieutenant in the reserves. He was one flight squadron of the Royal Hungarian Air Force. He was killed when his Hawk fighter crashed at an airfield near Ilos Goye, somewhere in Russia. So that's a sad thing. And this Prime Minister Calais. This is before the son was killed, but in early 1942, it says, this is from Wikipedia, but Horthy was already seeking to put some distance between himself and Hitler's regime. Of course, they're trying to say that Horthy was, you know, somehow always forced into all this and never really wanted to do it. Well, he was very ambivalent about some things, but in any case, he had a prime minister that was pro-German, whose name was Bardossi, and he dismissed this fellow and replaced him with this Miklos Calais, and he was supposedly a moderate, whom supposedly Horthy expected to loosen Hungary's ties to Germany or maybe to not have to go along with everything Germany wanted. So, you know, here we can see that this happened in early 42, I don't know exactly when, March, and sometime in March. And so in June, he sent this Calais to visit Hitler, and he had these requests that Hitler mentioned. And here's something that Horthy had written and said, I don't know exactly when, but about the Jewish problem, and shows his ambivalence. He says, I have been an anti-Semite throughout my life. I have never had contact with Jews. I have considered it intolerable that here in Hungary, every factory, bank, large fortune, business, theater, press, commerce, etc., should be in Jewish hands, and that the Jew should be the image reflected of Hungary, especially abroad. Since, however, one of the most important tasks of the government is to raise the standard of living, we have to acquire wealth, it is impossible in a year or two to replace the Jews who have everything in their hands. You know, Hitler was after Horthy constantly to round up the Jews in Hungary and put them in a concentration camp or turn them over to the Germans, and they would do it. And he was always making excuses, never wanted to do it. So here he's saying that why, you know, and this is what he always said, you know, that they're so powerful and there's so many of them and to replace, we don't have anybody to replace them with. He said they'd have to replace them with incompetent, unworthy, mostly big-mouthed elements. Well, I guess he's saying that Hungarian people didn't have anybody, you know, who could do what the Jews were doing. He says, for we should become bankrupt if we did that. This requires a generation at least. So, see, he wanted a generation to do something about the Jews, and Hitler wanted it done right away. And I know at one point Hitler, this was in 44, though, Hitler had a face-to-face discussion with him and told him how well Germany was doing with the Jews gone, you know, without the Jews in control of anything. But Horthy was just constantly trying to not have to do anything about the Jews. So this is, and now, you know, they got taken over by the Soviet Union, and then they continued to have their Jewish problem. Still have it today. President of Hungary today, Orbán, he's pretty good, but he's the same way. He can't really tackle that Jewish problem head on. He has to be nice to the Jews in one way, and another way, you know, he doesn't like them. But I thought that was all pretty interesting, because it's, once again, you know, he's talking about things that are going on right now that he's got dealings with right now. And he, of course, was saying how that Calais was there visiting with him.
You know, too, Carolyn, that hadn't been too long a time from this time he's talking about, 1942. It had only been 20 years before or so that... after World War One and the Red Revolutions, revolutionaries, all that broke out in different countries in Europe and different parts of Germany. Well, Hungary, that Jewish revolutionary named Béla Kun, who was born with the name Cohen, was in command of the Jews that took over Hungary or came close to it or whatever, the Hungarians were treated just like the Russians were under the Jewish commissars, and so they got a taste of the Jewishness stuff. And so the fact that there was some anti-Semitism in Hungary after all of that was taken care of and kicked out, that's no surprise. And so when it comes to this part right here, and you just read the part where he says, you know, as far as himself, he's never had any dealings with the Jews. He's been an anti-Semite and things like this. It's understandable, because what happened to Hungary in the late 1919 to 22 or so.
Yeah.
So they had
after World War One, at the Paris peace talks, I think it was the Treaty of Trianon that dealt with Hungary, they lost almost half their territory.
Mm-hmm.
And most of it was given to Romania, but other parts to here, there, and elsewhere. They lost more territory proportion-wise than Germany did, that's for sure. They were just decimated, and it's all Jewish dealings doing that. But I think that Horthy was showed that he didn't have the real guts to. He was so afraid of that his country would fall apart, I guess, that what the Jews would do to him, his country, that he couldn't act the way that Germany thought he should and wanted him to.
Well, so, I thought it was interesting, that request that he made. You know, it said he had two little requests, and one of them, the first one was that he should turn a benevolent blind eye if the Hungarians started a fight with the Romanians. And of course, and that's the last thing that Germany would have needed in its midst there, is a internal fight between those two countries.
Yeah, but see, and there's this bad feeling all the time, because Romanians were the beneficiary of all this Hungarian territory. And of course, they think that they have a right to it, but they're
right.
Even up to today, they don't like each other, and they're constantly pointing to the faults of the other one and how, you know, everything is their fault and so on. But Romania,
right,
in my opinion, Romania is too big for the kind of country it is, and they got too much of that Hungarian territory. And I don't know if Hungary is not very big, so Hungary should be a little bigger, and Romania is too big.
Yeah.
But that's just That's just from my me looking at the map. Doesn't seem right.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Okay. Under the Weimar Republic, treason assumed such proportions that even military secrets were published in the press and bandied about in open session in the Reichstag. When the foreign military commissions quitted Germany in 1925, they left behind them an organized intelligence service and spy ring, which not only rendered their further presence redundant, but, in the opinion of the military attachés accredited to Berlin, has also functioned to their complete satisfaction ever since. I was again and again infuriated by the state of moral degeneracy which alone made possible the setting up of this gigantic spy ring in Germany and which found expression in the most blatant and shameless form of treason. Even today, I remember a case where a member of the Reichstag asked in open session whether the government was aware of the fact that in X Street, a section of four tanks of the German Reichswehr had been seen, whose specifications were obviously contrary to the conditions imposed by the Versailles Treaty, and what action did the government propose to take in the matter? Alas, at that time, I could do no more than cause a list to be drawn up of all these traitorous elements so as to be in a position, after the assumption of power by the National Socialist Party, at least to punish these blackguards as they deserved. That we got rid of the majority of this riffraff in 1933 without having to do much about it is due to the fact that no fewer than 65,000 citizens of the state fled the country as soon as we came into power. I admit we did not know exactly what misdemeanor each individual had committed, but we were pretty safe in assuming that in most cases it was the dictates of their own consciences which caused them to flee abroad. A little later, quite a number of them thought better of it and showed an inclination to return to Germany. We quickly dammed this flowback of undesirable elements by announcing that all who returned would, as a matter of principle, have to pass through the concentration camps, and that any against whom crimes were proved would be liable to be shot. In this way, the Reich was freed of many thousands of antisocial elements, whom it would otherwise have been difficult to catch or fling out. Heydrich and his security service very soon broke up the rest, a service that was all the more valuable because the Department of Justice proved quite incapable of the task. Our Department of Justice frequently enraged me by handling of crimes of treason. For instance, on one occasion they recommended a traitor to mercy on the grounds that he was primarily employed as a smuggler and should therefore be dealt with as such. It was only with the greatest difficulty that I was able to persuade Dr. Gertner, the Minister for Justice, of the absolute necessity of exercising the utmost severity in cases of treason. When details of fortifications in East Prussia were betrayed, Gertner went so far as to recommend a mild punishment because, after all, the damage done was of a minor nature. I told Gertner pretty straight that it was quite impossible to judge what damage had been done. How could one tell whether one day one of these betrayed strong points would not be occupied in a war by a divisional commander and his staff and be destroyed? Such an event might have a decisive effect on operations. Was that damage of a minor nature? Eventually, I had to tell Gertner of my implacable resolve to have traitors, who had been too leniently treated by the normal courts, handed over to an SS commando and shot. For treason is an offense revealing a hostile mind, and every traitor must be executed regardless of the amount of damage he has done. Initially, the People's Court, set up under the aegis of the Department of Justice, did not, in my opinion, carry out its task with the measure of severity which I thought desirable. It was also by no means easy to make the legislature adapt itself to the obvious needs of the state, because the jurist members of the cabinet agreed only after much hesitation to accept treason as a crime revealing a hostile mind. In all the discussions on this subject, I found myself repeatedly compelled to say that such a thing as treason on idealistic grounds did not exist. The only type of treason which one might possibly regard as springing from certain moral inhibitions is a refusal to join the armed forces on grounds of religious conviction. But we should not fail to point out to these elements which refuse to fight on religious grounds that they obviously still want to eat the things others are fighting to get for them, that this was quite contrary to the spirit of a higher justice, and that we must therefore leave them to starve. And I regard it as an act of exceptional clemency that I did not, in fact, carry out this threat, but contented myself with shooting 130 of these self-styled Bible students. Bibelforscher. Incidentally, the execution of these 130 cleared the air, just like a thunderstorm does. When the news of the shootings was made public, many thousands of similarly minded people who proposed to avoid military service on the score of some religious scruple or other lost their courage and changed their minds. If you wish to wage war successfully or to lead a people successfully through a difficult period of its history, you must have no doubts whatever on one point, namely, any individual who in such times tries, either actively or passively, to exclude himself from the activities of the community must be destroyed. Anyone who for false reasons of mercy deviates from this clear principle is aiding, willingly or unwillingly, the dissolution of the state. We can see the beginnings of this process today in a country like Sweden. So, we get a clear picture very quickly about how he feels about the crime of treason and how it should be more broadly defined than it had been, especially under Weimar.
Yeah. Yeah, well, they're always making excuses for themselves, and they don't want to come down on anyone. Now, people will think, oh, that's just terrible. Oh, he had 130 Bible students shot. Well, one poor Bible students, that's a terrible thing to do.
Right.
Well, look at how
right.
these people do this in order to – it's like during Vietnam War here, we had all these people
yes.
They were students, you know, they went to school, they did that. They even left the country and went to Canada. And because it was such an unpopular war and, you know, nobody's going to defend it, you know, well, then we accept what these people were doing. But you couldn't have done that in World War II. The United States wouldn't have accepted anything like that going on in World War II. So, it's just... you know, you have to make decisions about things like this. And he comes down very clearly, like you said, on being on the hard side. And I just admire it. It just makes something in me so happy to sense that there's someone like him who has no problem with doing the hard thing. That doesn't have to be, you know, worried about what people are going to think of him, that he's not kindly enough or what have you.
Yeah.
It's always about the country, you know. It's always
yes.
about saving the country, which you can even say that Harvey was doing when he was afraid to do anything about the Jews because he was afraid of what it was going to do to his country. Now, that was his own, you know, point of view. But isn't it interesting? There's so many things to say about this, but here he mentions that he saw the beginnings of this in a country like Sweden. Wow. You know, we know what's happened to Sweden today.
Yeah.
What bad shape Sweden is in. They've just gone crazy there, you know. And
right.
he was seeing something going wrong there back then. That they were too liberal, too merciful, too unwilling to do what needed to be done.
And, you know, we've witnessed the Führer's frustration so much at trying to first advance his program in Germany, the National Socialist, and they got resistance from here and there and different elements, and he had to you know, the German Revolution, he had to endure so much garbage. But he tells right here, you know, it makes a very, very good point when he talks about when the foreign military commissions quitted Germany in 1925, they left behind an organized intelligence service and spy ring. And then right after that, he said, I was again and again infuriated by the state of moral degeneracy, which alone made possible the setting up of this gigantic spy ring in Germany. In other words, he's saying, you know, how badly the populace had been influenced by the liberal left and the garbage from Versailles. And he tells about some Germans themselves who said, tried to tattletale on these four tanks, which were supposedly forbidden to Germany. They were seen, and they, you know, asked the Weimar Republic, what are you going to do about this? And what this is agent provocateurs, Jews, troublemakers, whatever, that want to keep the country down to that level by making them think that this tattletale stuff is the right thing to do. And it had created a climate of fear in Germany, too, after Versailles. And and Hitler had to break that climate of fear and that hold on the people and this moral degeneracy that was pushed wholeheartedly by the Jews. So, you know, that section alone was very important to me because, you know, he went back to the roots of all of this stuff that had to be overcome, which National Socialism certainly did when it took hold.
Right, and that these people needed to be rooted out. They couldn't be tolerated within society because they were like poison. And I go along with you. I like where he said he was infuriated by the state of moral degeneracy and that he found after this spy ring was left behind and so on. You know, and that's what shows what an honest man Hitler was and how much he really cared and was working for Germany. He got infuriated by this kind of thing, and he uses language like that, you know, here and there. And anybody who gets infuriated themselves knows that that's a sign. That's just exactly how you feel about it.
Yeah, that's, you know, Hitler had a high tolerance, you know, but he, when he was pushed too far, he would talk like that, which was an excellent sign, as far as I'm concerned, you know, that, hey, enough is enough, and let's just tell it like it is.
Then I was thinking, though, how they got 65,000 citizens fled the country. 65,000 who felt they couldn't live under a Nazi state, a National Socialist state under Hitler. And then you think it's good that they're gone, but they're working against you from outside.
Yes.
And, but then I thought it's probably if you could catch them inside and actually execute them, you know, that's what you'd have to do in order to get rid
right.
of what they're doing against you. But he lets them go out and is just glad they're gone. And they're not. It's not as bad as if they were there, but you can't get hold of them outside of your country either. Then he said they, when they wanted to come back, he didn't make it easy for them, and so they changed their mind. That was good. But this is this whole thing about traitors, I think, is very important and needs to be understood, and Hitler needs to be understood as to why he feels the way he does about it. And I love this phrase, a hostile mind. And I noticed you emphasized that. You like it, too.
Yes.
And there's a German word for it, which is totally unpronounceable for someone like me. It's a German word that probably we can, the best they've done to translate it is calling it a hostile mind, which is a good thing to contemplate upon, I guess, you know. You don't want people who are hostile to what you're trying to do, and that's what he calls a treasonable offense. These traitors have a hostile mind.
Right, and now, anyone that supports, you know, they might want to stick up for the rights of such people if the government goes after them, that's the one he there ends up with by saying anyone who for false reasons of mercy deviates from this clear principle is aiding, willingly or unwillingly, the dissolution of the state. And meaning if you tolerate that under the guise of free speech or, well, these people can do and say what they feel, then you become very much as much of the danger towards the state as that violator himself is.
Yeah, and see, it all comes down to how you feel or think about the state. If you're against the state,
yes.
Well, you're going to see that as a as if, what, a, you know, a Medal of Honor or something that you're fighting against the state. But if you're, if you like the state, then you're a traitor to it. So it's not, you know, you have to take a stand there. And to, so when we talk about, see, National Socialist Germany was a different kind of a state. They didn't want free speech there in that sense. They didn't want people to have all different parties and everybody have their own idea and people fight it out, because he saw that's what caused this inability to get anything done, this parliamentarian type style of government, which nothing ever got done and nothing got done right. So, and you had all these people. Actually, that's what encourages traitors to be hanging around and working against you and so on. So it's totally, it's portrayed as totalitarianism, but it's just a different way of having your state. Now, you know, I just read about this. I don't know why I came up with him, but I did. This Ulrich Wilhelm Graf Schwerin von Schwanenfeld. Was Schwerin mentioned in here? I don't remember him being mentioned, but I came up with him anyway. As an example of a traitor, he was a big German traitor to the National Socialists, and he was killed in 1944, probably hung in September after the July assassination attempt. And he was a German landowner. He was an officer in the Wehrmacht and a resistance fighter. All for many, many years. He was born in Copenhagen, but he was German, I guess. And he found Nazism quite loathsome to his Christian social convictions, it says about him. So there we go again. So many of these who didn't like Hitler, it was based on, they said it was based on their Christian
convictions.
But what is a Christian social conviction except to be for the Jews, you know?
Yes,
and they found that so bad. And he started, it says, he already by 1935 he held the view that Adolf Hitler must be killed to be brought down, and so by 1935 they knew that Hitler had a program against the Jews to take away power from the Jews, at least that much by that part, you know, no marriage with Jews and so on.
Right.
And these Christians find this terrible, and there are a whole bunch of them, and they all say that, you know, these aristocrats, they. Remember we talked about before concerning with Prussia and the Poles and so on, that that these aristocrats like to go to deal with other high-living, property-owning people and so on. They don't care about the common people at all. They have their own kind of way of life, and they all socialize together, and they certainly socialized with the Jews and worked with the Jews, and the Jews were helpful to them and so on. So this is the way this goes. And this guy, there's a whole thing here about him. But he was at the Bendler Block on July 20th, 1944. A lot of them stayed there, and he was one of them that was arrested that night when Klaus Morris, forgetting his name now, the most famous one. But he was put on trial, and he was found guilty. So this is just an example, I thought, of this kind of traitor that Hitler was dealing with. But he didn't do anything about this guy until after that assassination attempt. You know, I mean, these people were trying to kind of lay low a little bit, I think, while they were fomenting all their plots. So it's, you know, it's dangerous. You know, there's a lot of danger around. Well, if you don't, if you want to say any more about that?
No, I think we can move on.
Okay. And so I've got a timeline for June 7th, 1942.
Okay.
Japanese forces invade Attu in Kiska. This is the first invasion of American soil in 128 years. So those were American-owned islands, I guess.
Off of Alaska.
Oh, okay. Okay. Good for you. Yeah. That's what the Japanese were going there. And they occupied those islands. And the Battle of Midway comes to a close. The USS Yorktown sinks, but four Japanese carriers and one cruiser are sunk also. The battle is viewed as a turning point in the Pacific War. Another thing is that the Greek People's Liberation Army makes its first appearance at Domnista, where Aris Velutiotis proclaims the start of armed resistance against the Axis. So the it's really too bad that the Greeks came in as so anti-Axis as they did. Well, I guess Italy had a lot to do with that. Anyway, that's it for the timeline.
Okay, we'll move on to 7th of June, 1942, at dinner. A procession at Barcelona, harassing the Falange. My distrust of Serrano Sr., superior resistance of Italians to church heresies, German emperors and the church, a requiem mass for the protector of Bohemia and Moravia. The Führer was informed that on the occasion of the Corpus Christi procession in Barcelona, the governor of the town forbade by edict the people taking part in the procession to wear the uniform either of the Falange, the Falangist militia, or any part of them. A solitary exception was made in favor of the regional chief of the Falange and his suite. It appears from the report that this prohibition was obtained by the nationalists through the medium of the church authorities. In this connection, it will be recalled that some weeks ago, incidents occurred between the nationalists and the members of the Falange, who nevertheless represent the official state party. It is further significant that the Madrid newspaper Arriba attacks this ban and states roundly that the wearing of the blue shirt is a duty to which the Falangists are in honor bound, and that all those who oppose them are despicable creatures. The Führer's opinion follows. One sees only too clearly from this sort of thing how the Spanish state is rushing toward fresh disaster. The priests and the monarchists, the same mortal enemies who oppose the resurgence of our own people, have joined together to seize power in Spain. If a new civil war breaks out, I should not be surprised to see the Falangists compelled to make common cause with the Reds to rid themselves of the clerico-monarchical muck. What a pity it is that the blood shed in common by the Falangists, the fascists, and the National Socialists during the war has not brought better results. But in Spain, unfortunately, someone will always be found willing to serve the political interests of the church. Serrano Sr., the present Minister for Foreign Affairs, is one of them. From my first meeting with him, I was conscious of a feeling of revulsion, in spite of the fact that our ambassador, with abysmal ignorance of the facts, introduced him to me as the most ardent Germanophile in Spain. That the fascists were spared a second civil war is due to the fact that the movement initiated in Rome succeeded in uniting the Italian nation in spite of the opposition of the church. Further, fascism clearly defined the position as regards what things fell within the sphere of the church and what things fell within the sphere of the state. When the church refused to recognize the law for the formation of the fascist youth organization, the fascists retaliated by ruthlessly breaking up every religious procession from Rome right down to the south of Italy. The result was that within 3 days the church had come to heel. Speaking generally, the history of Italy shows that the Italian people adopt a very much more realistic attitude towards the church than do the Spaniards, or alas, not a few Germans. Is it not a sad thought that each time the Italians flung out some pope or the other, there was always a German Kaiser ready and willing to restore order in the Vatican? I must be honest and confess that I myself have not been guiltless in this respect. By creating a Bishop of the Reich, I tried to bring a little clarity into the equivocal situation in the evangelical church. When I see what is happening today in Spain, I congratulate myself on the failure of my efforts. Once more, Providence prevented me from committing a mistake I was on the point of making. Who indeed is prepared to give me a guarantee that one fine day the Protestant Bishop of the Reich will not make common cause against me with the Pope? The established religions, and particularly the Catholic Church, are adepts at presenting an innocent mien and in flattering the man in power. I myself experienced this when, shortly after assuming power, I received a visit from the Bishop of Bertram. He brought me the good wishes and the homage of the Catholic clergy with such unction that, had I not known differently from bitter personal experience, I would not have believed it possible that a single National Socialist could have been excluded from the Church on account of his convictions, or could have been persecuted and even execrated after death. It is with such semblance of humility that the Church has always wormed its way into power and succeeded in winning its way by flattering into the good graces of the German emperors from Charlemagne onward. It is the same technique as that employed by sophisticated women, who at first exude charm in order to gain a man's confidence, and then gradually tighten the strings until they hold him so firmly that the man dances like a puppet to their whims. With a little diplomatic savoir-faire, such women manage even to persuade their husbands, exactly as in the case of the Church and the German emperors, that it is they who rule the roost, and this in spite of the nose ring on which they are so obviously being led. Quite recently, the Church tried to pull off a new one of this kind. The Bishop of Bohemia and Moravia begged permission to be allowed to hold a requiem mass with chimes for SS Gruppenführer Heydrich. I told the gentleman bluntly that he would have been much better employed if he had previously offered prayers for the safety and welfare of the Reich Protector.
Hmm. Yeah, that's nice there at the ending. You know, saying instead of wanting to do masses, but it would have been better if people would have helped him, I guess, given their prayers before he was killed. But I don't think that would have done any good either.
Right.
Well, there's a lot of interest in this, I must say.
I was going to ask you in the initial intro to this, before the Fuhrer starts to speak, it says, talking about this report, it says, saying that there should be a prohibition of wearing the phalange uniform by them or the militia or any part of them, and they shouldn't be allowed to wear that uniform or the blue shirt or anything in that ceremony. And he says this prohibition was obtained by the nationalists through the medium of the church authorities. And you see, when I think of the term nationalists or nationalism, you would think that those would have been the people who were supporting ardently the phalange.
Yeah, but see, like, that's why I said earlier that in Spain, it's the leftists who were called the nationalists. You know, it's always been very confusing. And when you read about the Spanish Civil War, it's very confusing if you don't have that real clear in your mind.
True.
And then there's
true.
The Republicans. I think they were the Republicans, too. No, I can't. Actually get it confused. But I know the Franco people were the militarist type, sort of thought about. And well, and here you have, because it was a church procession, you see, they didn't want these phalangists to wear their type of uniforms. They forbade it. See, that's what the church does. That's why this is brought up here, I suppose, that this is... And what happened?
Yeah,
well, somebody said that, you know, that was wrong, but they probably weren't not able to do it.
Well, yeah, and immediately Hitler takes off by saying the priests and the monarchists, the same mortal enemies who oppose the resurgence of our own people.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, he quickly recognized that in Spain and that particular edict. And then he goes on to rightly and correctly say that the Italians had a lot more sense than that. They didn't knuckle under or give that much credence to dictates by the church in Italy, and that's one reason why the Italian Revolution succeeded well beyond the Spanish one.
Right. And you know, he's generally is saying here in tonight's segments that the church prefers monarchy. And the monarchists and the church usually get along real well together. And Hitler has talked previously of how he was really down on monarchy. He didn't see that as a way, even though so many people say that's a good traditionalist way of doing things and we should go back to monarchy. There are some good things about it, but Hitler had decided that that was not the way to go at all. You had to be much more revolutionary. That was too tied to, you know, the establishment people and so on. And, of course, the church, what I see is that he's becoming increasingly more and more anti-church.
Yes.
As his time as chancellor, and of course he was more than just chancellor, he was the total leader of Germany. But you know, and the war and everything, as all this goes on, he sees what's happening in Germany and also in these other countries. His ideas have maybe not hardened, but have become more set and more clear to him, and he's very much against the church. You know, here he says, is it this one? Yeah, it has to be that. He says that he would no longer go along with the idea of having a bishop of the Reich. And, you know, this is something so many people like to talk about, and I used to, too, you know, the German Christian Church and all that, you know, and there's a lot of nice things you can feel about that, but here now he's gone past that, and he's saying he's glad now that never happened, and he didn't want to have a bishop of the Reich. So he's just becoming more, you know, we don't want Christianity, we don't want to deal with church people and so on, and we don't want monarchy either. We don't want these aristocrats like the one I was talking about before, who are mostly traitors. You know, they don't care about the people. He was really a total, and becoming more so, a revolutionary. Well, he always was, but he was having to go along with people, you see. Just like, you know, Franco does and Mussolini, but he's happy that he managed to not get stuck in these places where he was going along. And so he says, you know, Providence, again, helped me out here by making that, well, I wasn't successful in doing that, and how glad I am now that I wasn't.
Sure.
So that's what I see is happening here.
Oh, yeah. You know, and part of this article here, too, I realized after I'd read this little section what a great propaganda value this, what happened was to the enemy as far as portraying part of the revolutionary force in Spain, in this instance, the fascist, very, very negatively, where he says the church, the Catholic Church, when they refused to recognize the law for the formation of the fascist youth organization, well, the fascists retaliated, and you see, it's never presented that way in the foreign press, and it would be in France, England, the United States, that this was a retaliatory measure taken by the fascists, but it said the fascists retaliated by ruthlessly breaking up every religious procession from Rome right down to the south of Italy, and as a result of that, then the church came around and came to heel. And this was quite an accomplishment and a very positive thing, whereas the enemy, of course, that were against all thing nationalist and free thinking, jumped all over that, and many, many articles about fascist youth smashing up church processions, you know, in a bully boy manner. And, you know, so it's like I've said many, many times to my classes, that you are never really, you've told that you've got a free press, but you are never really given the real instance of what is action and what is reaction. And you have to know that to discern honesty, discern righteousness, or who holds the better measure of truth. You have to know what is action and what is reaction. And this was a pretty good instance of it. Like I say, when the fascist youth organization busted up all church processions and everything because they weren't allowed to organize, then the church came to heel. But this particular motion was presented as an action by the fascist youth organizations rather than a reaction to what the church had tried to do to keep to prohibit them from being formed. So it was a pretty good example of that.
Yeah, you're right. Well, okay, so we can get through this next one, I think. June 8th.
I think we can.
Okay.
June 8th, 1942, at dinner. The role of coming generations, extension of the Germanic idea, a new name for the Reich capital. Youth should lead youth. Ridiculous anomalies in religious divergence. Influence of the National Socialist youth within the family. Penurious inadequacy of school teachers. Propaganda. The role of the press in national education. During dinner, photographs were passed around showing the Reich youth leader in the company of youth group leaders, male and female, from Norway, Denmark, Holland, etc. The Führer expressed himself as follows. It is an excellent thing that Axmann has been at the front as a soldier. The loss of an arm in battle will undoubtedly enhance his prestige with the youths, not only of Germany, but also of the other countries. I'm very pleased, too, to welcome Axmann's efforts and to see how he strives continuously to bind the youth of the German lands with ever closer bonds to National Socialism and to the German way of thought. For once youth has been won over to the idea, an action like that of yeast sets in. Youth effervesces and goes on working and working for an idea, regardless of anything that the older generation can do to stop them. Even in Denmark, the opposition of the older generations will not prevent the youth from adopting in ever increasing numbers the German way of thought, for they feel they spring from the same racial origins. By methodically supporting the development of this movement, I am cutting the ground from under the feet of the old king of Denmark and drawing his people away from him, in exactly the same way as I succeeded at the time in estranging the people of Austria slowly but surely from the Dollfuss Schuschnigg regime. Following the example of Bismarck, who never ceased to preach the pan-Germanic idea to the Bavarians, the Prussians, etc., we must systematically draw all the Germanic peoples of continental Europe into the German channel of thought. I really believe that by renaming Berlin the capital of our Reich, Germania, we would give very considerable impetus to the movement. The name Germania for the capital of the Reich in its new representative form would be very appropriate, for it would give to every member of the German community, however far away from the capital he may be, a feeling of unity and closer membership. There would be no technical difficulty about renaming Berlin, as we can see from the Germanization of Gdynia into Gotenhafen and the changing of the name of Lodz into Litzmannstadt. In the same way as the press, the school also must be used as an instrument for the education of the people and must therefore be organized and directed without any regard for private interests. The school alone, however, as the instrument for the education of youth, does not suffice because it is too prone to give priority of interest to purely academic achievement. It is for this reason that I have formed the supplementary organization of the Hitlerjugend and endowed it with the bold motto, Die Jugend von Jugend geführt werden soll. Youth must be led by youth. In this way, I have set up in their very early years a process of selectivity amongst young people, whereby the little group leaders soon select themselves. To the judgment of the schoolmaster, who normally confines himself to exact scholastic attainments, is thus added by the Hitler Youth the judgment of the youth leaders, which lays primary value on character, that is, on a sense of comradeship, endurance, courage, and qualities of leadership. The effective value of the school and the Hitler Youth as instruments of education depends on the quality of the instructors. In the choice of leaders for the Hitler Youth and of teachers for the Department of Education, our first principle must be to ensure that these instructors of both kinds are chosen from men who will remain as an example to youth for the rest of their lives exactly as the instructors in the gymnasia of ancient Greece set the example of bodily and spiritual perfection to the youth submitted to their charge. It is between the ages of 10 and 17 that youth exhibits both the greatest enthusiasm and the greatest idealism, and it is for this period of their lives that we must provide them with the best possible instructors and leaders, for only the very best will guarantee the high standard of education at which we uniformly aim. The criminal follies committed under the Weimar Republic in the field of education were most clearly demonstrated to me by a report on the conditions obtaining in Baden at the time of our assumption of power. The factional splitting of youth education in Baden had been carried to such a pitch that there were actually separate water closets for Protestant and Catholic children. The government of the time was apparently blissfully ignorant of the corrosive poison which such a partition of the educational system injected into the soul of youth. It is also during these years of adolescent development that a child's sensibility is at its strongest. How many of our leading party members were originally brought into the National Socialist movement by the influence of their own children? Again and again, young people, filled with enthusiasm for National Socialism, have succeeded first in persuading their mother and then, with her help, in winning over the father for the NSDAP. It is therefore most important that a proper appreciation of the requirements of youth should be inculcated and strengthened among the teachers in schools. For the ensuring of a continuous supply of school teachers, we must not overlook the claims of those who, from their environment or as a result of their professional activities, are particularly suited to the purpose. I am thinking primarily in this respect of the women and the time-expired soldiers. In my opinion, women teachers and ex-soldiers are ideal for the elementary schools. There is no need to give these teachers any exaggerated form of training or to stuff their heads till they become stupid with mental indigestion. All that is required is to equip them with just the knowledge that is essential for the elementary schools. A teacher who is destined to spend his life in a village has no need of high academic learning. This does not at all mean that teachers who prove exceptionally efficient should be deprived of the opportunity of promotion. One does not keep a keen officer forever drilling recruits. If one did, he'd probably hang himself. In the same way, the best of our teachers must be given the chance of advancement into the higher branches of their profession and not be condemned to teach forever in the elementary schools. And in particular, we must make it easy for them to be promoted from elementary to intermediate schools. Reichsleiter Bormann has just told us that there is such a dearth of teachers in the Werthegau that it has been necessary to reduce the period of preparatory training even below that obtaining in Austria. Personally, I don't think that matters very much. Those who feel within themselves the urge to hire things will use their free time in seeking the necessary knowledge. The important thing is that all those who feel that they are worthy of an intermediate or higher education should know that the state will pave their way as regards both instruction and study. Conversation then turned to questions of administration, the complexities of its organization, and the duplication of effort, which not infrequently ensued. The Fuhrer said, "In my opinion, it's a mistake to set up a propaganda department in each ministry, and even in some of the higher administrative departments. The Ministry of Propaganda and the Press Service of the Reich are there to meet all needs. I have myself set an example in the Chancellery by refraining from setting up any special propaganda or press department, and I did not find that this in any way hinders the immediate fulfillment of any press or propaganda instructions I issue. When I'm traveling, I can stop at any railroad station, give any instructions I consider necessary, and be sure that through the medium of the press and the radio, by the next morning, public opinion will be properly prepared for any political announcement I may have to make, even a Russo-German pact. It is only by means of the concentration of the whole machinery of press and propaganda in one single organization that a unified direction of the press can be assured. And a unified press is a prerequisite if the press is to enjoy the confidence of the people, and thus also to become effective as an instrument of popular education. For only a unified press is free from those contradictions of news items, of political, cultural, and such like communications, which make it laughable in the eyes of the public, rob it of any prestige as a purveyor of truth, and of any value as an instrument for the education of public opinion. How little this was understood in the circle of the so-called national press was brought home to me in 1920 in the course of an altercation with the Reverend Traub, the editor of Eisern Blatter. When I told the reverend gentleman as bluntly as I could that a free press must give way to a unified and controlled press, because the former was nothing more or less than a free forum for the dissemination of Jewish impertinences, he crumpled entirely. The mentality of the so-called nationalists of the type of Reverend Traub was very correctly assessed by Dietrich Eckert when he declared that the Eisern Blatter, the Pages of Iron, should more properly be called Blechern Blatter, Pages of Lead. What an enormously important instrument for the education of public opinion the press could become was never understood by the so-called nationalists. And yet, what other instrument is so well suited to the purpose? I myself put the press on the same footing as the Department of Education, and in both cases, I maintain private interests must play no part whatsoever, either in their organization or in the control of them.
Mm-hmm.
That's an interesting, a very interesting section there, because it's more and more emphasizing the value of the state and the responsibility of the state and in controlling things like what dumb Americans think is a free media and a free press. Uncontrolled as it is here and owned by the same cabal everywhere, the people are misled. As everyone knows, all the time, no truth to what is said, and directing people towards so-called patriotism and wars and crap like that is abundantly rife. But Hitler could tell that back in Germany, too, that if the press is not a unified instrument of education for the benefit of the state and not the benefit of private interests, then you'll never get a nation off the ground. It'll just wither. So to me, that's what all that was about. And the little part about the Die Jugend von Jugend geführt werden soll, that youth must be led by youth, I thought that was effective. I thought that was really nice. Youth... selecting and learning how to select among themselves those of competence and with true natural abilities.
Oh yeah, and that's the whole thing that really was that way. At the local level, you started out and you had people in your local area who were the leaders, and you could become a leader yourself if you proved to have these qualities that they mentioned here. And that's you can see that going on with Wenger, Leopold Wenger. He was a Hitler youth leader for a long time in his town, and then he moved on to go to that Napolis school, and he would have gone on to become quite the leader. He was a squadron leader in the war. That's not an easy job either. So, you have, and I like the way he said this, from 10 to 17, when you're 10 years old, that's the fourth grade in this country.
Yes.
And I've always thought that fourth grade was a wonderful year, kids in the fourth grade. And there's such a difference between third grade and fourth grade. To me, at least in my experience, there's such a jump that takes place. And mm-hmm. fourth graders are, by 10, you're starting to think on a different level, and you have a lot of idealism and and friendliness toward your classmates and so on. And you're ready to do a lot of things, which is sometimes taken advantage of. But it all depends on what you believe. Because as you were saying, this unified press, unified by the government, you know, is really
yes.
propaganda. And, you know, you can say, well, then you've got a propaganda press because it's not free. And, you know, there's a lot of truth to that. But if you believe in the propaganda, you think it's good. If you don't, then you don't. So I don't know that there's always going to be people against things.
You're right. It would be very difficult to overcome the mindset in this country of this sentence that Hitler, where he says, talking about a free press, was nothing more nor less than a free forum for the dissemination of Jewish impertinences. And we know that. We know that's the case in the United States of America. And so we're sick of it. And you know, it's like the media is certainly not on my side. It's not my friend. It doesn't feed me the truth. It's, you know, it's a private interest. And so that way, you know, I'm much more open to a controlled press. I certainly believe in freedom and freedom of thought.
Depends on who
the
leadership is.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
That's an excellent point.
Yeah.
You know.
We got to close the show now. So
okay.
I want to, once again, I guess, wish everybody a happy new year, and we're looking forward to a good year. And this has been Hitler's Table Talk on January 1st, 2015. Good night.
Good night, folks.